Hi, I'm here today with David Cadavy, author of Design for Hackers, and which was one of the first books that I read to get a sense of design. So I was super excited when David finally took that content and made it into an online course. David, it's great to have you here.
Ankur, thank you very much. It's good to hear that you enjoyed reading my book too.
Yeah,
So,
your book.
thanks.
I think your flow was your book, then your email course, and then the video course. Is that how it
Yeah,
all
that's
played out? Sweet.
exactly how it went. I did it like probably the opposite way of how I should have done
Yes.
it.
So how did the idea come about?
So, Design for Hackers was kind of the culmination of about a 3-year process of just pure exploration. I worked in Silicon Valley for a few years, and I worked for startups. I got my degree in graphic design. I've been obsessed with design and drawing since I could hold a pencil. And then, worked for startups, and then kind of got tired of the whole venture-backed startup game and moved away from Silicon Valley. I actually left Silicon Valley,
Good
moved
call.
to.
I did the same.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, you're in New York. I moved to Chicago. I still can't explain why, but and just to like explore whatever it was that was inside of my brain. And after a few years of messing around with a ton of different projects, I was submitting a proposal to speak at South by Southwest. I was like, well, I'm not famous, so I'll just write this really brain-melting blog post, try to get votes for my panel. And I did that, and that post was number one on Hacker News, which was easier at that time. And then a couple days later, I got an email from Wiley asking me if I wanted to write a book.
Oh,
And
nice. So
so I
you don't
said
even pitch a
yes.
book, they pitched you.
They pitched me, yeah. And it was it was something that happened with. I get asked a lot of times by some people. Sometimes they're asking like, oh, should I write a book? Should I do this? And it's hard to answer that question because it came with such force of just my experiences all connecting and converging. These disparate things, interests that I had, these disparate dots all connecting and converging in this one particular moment, where when that opportunity came along, I was just like, it was very clear that that was the thing for me to do. It was the right thing for me
Nice.
to do.
So is that typical? I mean, does Wiley normally pitch books to people, or is that a strategy, or did you just get lucky, or?
I reached out to other authors as soon as I got that request, other authors that I knew, thankfully. And I did hear that Wiley was pretty aggressive with finding talent to write books, and that they do reach out a lot. And actually, a couple weeks later, I was reached out to by another publisher,
Oh wow.
and when I wrote some
All
other blog
from the
posts,
blog, oh, all from blog posts.
all from blog posts, yeah,
Nice.
just because they were just going bonkers. I mean, I didn't think that much of, oh, I got 30,000 views on this post in a few days. I thought like, oh, that's cool, but I guess it didn't really hit me like what it was really gonna mean to my life and my career. I do have to I do will add though that I did speak to I spoke to a few agents when that happened, a few book agents, and one of them that I spoke to, Stephen Hanselman, who was the agent for, I don't want to get all this wrong, but I think he's been the agent for Tucker Max and Tim Ferriss, and he wasn't available at the time, but he did take time to talk with me for an hour, and got great feedback from him. And he was, I was telling him about the process that I had going with Wiley, where it's like, yeah, I'm submitting this proposal thing, and he just like was really amazed at how fast it was happening. So, I guess it might have been a little unusual in that way, but yeah, I think that's what happens when an idea has life and has force that way, and you're not forcing it yourself so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes you just know. It's rare that that happens. I mean, I've started more failed companies than, a lot of people, but sometimes you just know. You just have so much momentum that it's almost unstoppable.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these things where every angle that you think of it from, you're like, okay, should I not do it because this? And you're like, well, wait, yeah, no, I should. Like, there's just like you said, when you know, you know. It was just very clear. This was what I had been waiting for. This was the reason that, you know, actually it was 3 years prior that I had stopped working for other people, just because I felt this sort of sense of unease about what I was spending my time doing, but I didn't know what the thing that I was supposed to be doing was. And
so it's almost like you found your purpose.
Yes, and it was a process of exploration.
Nice.
And it was, and I had to trust that process myself, and that was a long and lonely process. But you know, fortunately, when that happens, I had already set up some passive revenue on the side. I had you know, purposely not had many clients, and they were sort of winding down anyway. And so when that happened, when I got the opportunity for that book deal, it was like, yeah, this is totally clear. This is totally happening. So
nice.
I don't really have any, I mean, there's ways to go about making stuff like that happen, but in some ways it's kind of a magical thing.
Nice. I mean, I'm sure, you know, this magical calling, it happened, it was amazing, but it probably took a lot of work, you know, between the proposal and actually having a book.
Yes.
What was that process like?
So it took about 3 months to come up with a proposal for that book.
Oh, that's just a proposal.
not the proposal. Yeah. The proposal was pretty simple. It was like writing outlines and kind of saying, like, it was all, it was funny, it was kind of all already in my head, like the structure of what I wanted to talk about. And it was painful and difficult to get it out, but I did manage to get it out. But from that first email to signing the contract, it took about 3 months or so.
Okay. But it was not 3 months of work. I mean, that's just, you know, delay in communication.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Delays in communication. When people ask me how long the book took to write, my response is always 6 months plus a lifetime. Because, I mean, it truly was, you know, I was, like, obsessed with this stuff to, like, an unhealthy degree for many, many years.
It's all the information you've collected, both directly, subliminally, just like, you know, doing your other job. All of that experience probably, you know, came into the book and pretty much anything you ever do in the future.
Yeah. And, so, you know, there was the signing the contract. Then there was a 6 month process of doing the writing, which was, I can't lie. It was horrible. It was a really cold winter.
Yeah.
I just had to cut off all social life and you just put everything that I had into it. And
did you have like a solid routine, or were you just like do nothing for 4 days and then go crazy for three? Or were you like methodical? Like, I got to wake up and write between like 9 and 3 every day.
I would have so much better of a handle on this process now than I did back then.
Yeah,
since I've been through it. But it was a lot of thrashing. It was a lot of freaking out over what a huge project that I had to do, and having a lot of pressure on myself because this was gonna be my life's work up to that point.
Yep.
As far as I was concerned, in that book, and. So it was, it was a lot of agony, a lot of like, just constantly worrying about it. And then eventually like having this 15-minute span of like
clarity,
flow, where just tons of stuff got written and done. And so I've actually, I mean, since then been very interested in the process of how to make that sort of thing happen, but that's another story.
So what would you do differently now, right? Because you said there's a lot of things. If you had to redo the writing process, you would change.
Yeah. Now I'm trying to think of how to describe this in a way that...
So I'll give you an example. One of the things, you know, we tell people to do with courses, at least, we find works really well, is to set a really, really aggressive deadline.
Yeah.
And to produce almost a minimum viable course. Yeah. Obviously, it's a little bit different with a book because a book is not a living product. You know, once a book ships, it truly ships. But what I find useful for motivation is picking a really, really aggressive deadline, like something that sounds almost a little bit crazy, and then just pushing to do the best you can by that specific day.
Yeah, that's what I have learned to do with my courses, for sure. When it came to the book, you know, we had 25%, I had a 25% deadline, like, rolling. Maybe I could have come with a different way of doing it. But you know, what I was going to say was that I always try to think of a way to describe this stuff without having a curse of knowledge. I think a lot of people who are experts who have been through certain processes really forget about all of the micro skills that they had to learn in order to do this big thing. And I think that just finding ways to kill that feeling of overwhelm would have been really good. Having some structure.
So it's almost balancing your psychology, a lot of that, right? Or
yeah, I think, you know, maybe writing, instead of writing the whole book, like writing a few barf paragraphs from each chapter, so you kind of have like the whole book there, and then digging deeper and drilling down. And I did find ways to codify things where, you know, in my writing process, there is what I call scaffolding, which other people might call outline.
Yep.
Barf draft, which is just write, don't care about what it is. And when you are writing the barf draft,
I like that barf draft. I'm going to use that.
I call it barf draft.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. I know exactly. As soon as you said it, I knew exactly what you're talking about.
It's just like
write shit. Like,
and eventually, sometimes you go back over and read it, and you're like, actually, that's pretty good. Even at the time you're writing it, you're like, oh, this is, I'm embarrassed.
You just want to produce something. Yeah.
Yeah, and then while writing the barf draft, there's always these things these speed bumps that you get where maybe there's a fact or something that you're like, oh God, what's the right year? Who did that? These things that require research, just roll right over those, put them in brackets.
Interesting.
And then you have a separate phase, a separate work session where you go back and you research all those things.
Yeah.
Then there was also exploration, which is times where I'm like, I just do a bunch of reading of just random things that are meet my curiosity. You know, in my brain, like I'm looking out for little tidbits and stories and things that I can integrate into what I have. So having like recognizing the different sort of layers of the process and realizing that you're not just like writing this book like perfectly edited copy like straight through. You're not going to do that. I've heard some people write that way. That does not work for me and for my nervous system in particular because I. That feeling of overwhelm gets managed a lot better when you work in, for me, when I work in layers, where I have a feeling like there's some sort of plan here and that I am going to be able to meet this deadline and make this thing happen.
Yeah. So now that you've, you know, completed writing this book, have you thought about potentially writing another book, or are you just looking at that kind of as your masterpiece that you keep on improving upon?
I am constantly thinking about other books, and I was thinking about other books before I even came across this book. And I take that exploration like now in layers more, where I do think about how am I going to package this idea, how can I test that packaging in a way where I can get an understanding if that's the right direction.
Yep.
So there's things that other ideas that I explore. But it is a struggle there's so much more that I can do with this Design for Hackers thing that I've got going on, and I don't want to fall too victim to shiny object syndrome.
Yep.
At the same time.
Yeah.
But there's also these other ideas that I'm really excited about that I want to pursue. So I'm always trying to figure out ways to like, all right. If I have this other idea, is there some way I can integrate this same sort of idea into what's already going on with Design for Hackers and that those can start to feed each other?
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. It's one of those things that even as I've been, you know, trying to buckle down on, you know, building Fedora, which is a company, in the past I'd have all these, you know, moments where I find something really fun that's so distracting that now my best strategy is to try and fit them into the bigger picture of how they can be useful in what I'm doing right now.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's funny because it's easy to recognize that, oh, there were all these fun things that I did before that led to little things that made what I'm doing now possible.
Yep.
So they're not completely valueless, but how can you be more strategic about about being distracted in a way that is going to be beneficial to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So if you were to write another book now, I mean, you've, you know, matured a lot. The industry has matured a lot. Would you still get a publisher?
It all depends upon the idea and the goals for the book. The thing that I think about a lot is there's like a temptation to want to try to get like a New York Times bestseller, to write a New York Times bestseller or something. Yeah. Now, is that me? Is that just some sort of silly ego thing? If I do want to do that, then I will need a publisher. Yeah. But at the same time, you can have more creative control. Yeah. I've got an audience. I've got 30,000 people on my email list. I have some fans that are extremely dedicated.
Yeah.
If I were to self-publish and get most of the money in that case, then it's like I would probably make more money off of it, and I could do whatever I want. There's also a lot of work with publishing books.
Yep.
Like, people ask me about self-publishing, like, for Design for Hackers. It never would have happened.
Yep.
The book never would have happened without Wiley. I would have never had the guts and foresight to be able to buckle down like that, that hard, for that long, and do all these other things. Like, they did all the layout, they did, like, they had great designers that did the book cover design under my direction, and distribution. Like, I was in Singapore, and I met a person who was like, "Oh yeah, I bought your book at this store down the street."
Yeah,
I can't do that.
Yeah,
maybe you can. I'm not quite sure.
No. That, I mean, I think that actually is a big reason why publishers still work. As you said, it might not be an ego thing, but I mean, it's pretty cool to walk into a Barnes & Noble or to walk into a store and to see your name up there, with the other books.
I mean, I do that when I'm in New York. I'll usually just drop by the Barnes & Noble and see if there's a couple copies of my book, and I'll take it and I'll say, "Hey, I wrote this book. Can I sign it?" And so I'll like sign it and tweet out. That's fun.
Nice.
There's also the thing with just credibility too. I can't lie. Like, I like it to. It's kind of fun sometimes when you meet somebody and they're like, "Oh," and you tell them that you wrote a book, and they're like, "Oh, well, yeah, you self-publish," and then you're like.
Yeah.
And you start telling the details, and then their eyes start to light up. They're like, "Oh, okay, this person's not a hack."
Yeah, I think that's a good point,
sad, but
right?
True.
Because everyone can self-publish a book. There's no credibility associated with self-publishing, even though, I mean, there's a lot of books kind of going that direction. And personally, I do think that's where the industry is going, right? I mean, I think long-term, more books are going to be self-published than not. And the lines between self-publishing and a publisher will keep getting more blurred.
It all depends upon, what sort of distribution you have and what your goals are. If I think of somebody like James Altucher, self-published and had a Wall Street Journal bestseller and USA Today bestseller, can't get New York Times list as a self-published author pretty much. But he's got huge credibility triggers. He's been on TV a lot and I would consider myself to be a successful author, but I don't have, a PhD.
Yeah.
I'm not. I haven't been a journalist for the New York Times or for whatever. And so there's considerations like that too.
Yeah. No. I mean, we're indirectly trying very hard to get James to teach a course on Fedora. He's promised us he will because he's indirectly an investor.
Yeah.
But,
I love his work.
Yeah.
I listen to his podcasts all the time.
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is a good point to kind of pivot into online courses.
Yeah.
I know we've had a good amount of success in the past and more success moving forward, getting people that used to be authors to write, to create a course. Because in a lot of ways, an online course is very close to what the same problem of the book is trying to fix, right? Just a different form factor, a different medium to kind of solve the same problem for people. How did you decide, to create an online course version for your book? Was it just people pestering you?
Well, there was a combination of a few different things. One, I met a lot of people who were like, "Oh man, I bought your book. It's great." And they're like, "But I haven't finished it yet."
Yeah.
Maybe it came to this realization that you write a book and you just like throw it on someone's lap. You're like, "Hey, good luck.
Yeah.
Like, have fun with that." And then also, this is a sort of a roundabout thing, is that my book is available in a few different languages.
Yep.
It's not available in Spanish, which is weird because I've spent a lot of time in Latin America.
Yep.
I've spoken in Spanish-speaking countries. For whatever reason, Wiley hasn't made a Spanish-language deal. I do not have the rights to make a Spanish language book.
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
I do have the rights to create a course. So I've spent the last few winters in South America. I decided, like last winter, I'm just going to make a Design for Hackers course in Spanish. So I tried it. I did like a sample chapter. I got it translated. Realized it's really hard to speak in Spanish, even if your Spanish is okay.
Yeah.
Then I was like, all right, well, I'll just like do the English.
Closed captioning.
Hopefully someday there will be a Spanish one, finally. But that was part of it. But then, you know, through like creating the course, I realized, this is a great opportunity.
Yep.
Especially because I have the free email course that a lot of people take. This is a great opportunity to give somebody a completely different experience.
Yep.
You know, to say like, all right, this isn't me dropping a book on your lap. This is me chunking things up and saying like, you know, for mine, it's like, here's a 5-minute video. Here's a 10-minute challenge, which is like, set a timer for 10 minutes. It's like an exercise program. 10 minutes, do this little exercise. You know, I've got like a community aspect to it too, where people can start, where the rubber hits the road, where people can talk about the things that they're working on and how it relates to their day-to-day stuff. We've got people from all sorts of different backgrounds, which, you know, it serves those students really well, but it also counts, it's also great customer research.
Yep.
People are talking about what particular problems they're solving with your course. You get new ideas for improving that course or for making other courses for more specific needs. I guess a combination of things, the idea of that someday I could have it available to Spanish-speaking people, I wanted to be able to motivate people better. And, you know, also, it's nice to be able to make money, to have something to sell.
Yep.
Where, you know, we've got a publisher, you know, it's great. They do a lot of stuff for you. They take all the money. You know, they take a lot of the money.
That's kind of where I was going to get is the economics of courses, at least from you. I mean, obviously you don't have to give specific numbers, but as a percentage of kind of the lifetime value of, you know, Design for Hackers, what percentage do you think has come from the course?
I released the course about 6 months ago or so.
Yeah.
The book came out 3 years ago.
Yep.
I've probably now made more from the course than I have from the book during its lifetime.
I mean, I'm not surprised, but I think a lot of people will be surprised, which is why I asked the question.
Yeah.
Makes sense from kind of, you know, the fact that the unit price for course is much higher. You keep almost all of it.
I could have made even more. It's just that I'm very, very, I'm very methodical, and so I'm only marketing my course to people who are on my email list.
Yeah.
Every time I launch it, I'm like praying that somebody won't like add it to Product Hunt or something.
I know.
Like
I tried to help by offering to add it to Product Hunt.
Oh yeah, you're right. Yeah, and you did. That's right. You were one of the people.
David, let's blow this up. This is a huge opportunity. We'd love to power it, but you're like, no. I'm taking it very slowly.
No, yeah, I wanna like really start with, you know, that whole early adopter cycle. My fans, people who get my particular approach to design, which is very different from most of what you see out on the web, I want to understand them, and I want to make that product great for them in particular. Then I can start worrying about winning over people who have never had contact with me.
Yep.
Because I got to say, like, I mean, I'm not a quick win sort of person, and like, I think that people outside of my audience might not really, they're not going to get it right away.
Yeah.
So I'm not concerned with it. So that's, in a lot of ways, I'm leaving a lot of money on the table.
Yeah.
I mean, for now.
You're remarkably patient. I know a lot of other people in a similar situation that would have wanted to, you know, kind of maximize the value right away. But your patience is, you know, it's pretty commendable, and I'm sure your audience appreciates it.
Yeah. Thanks. I mean, this seems to be like the way that I've operated my whole life is whenever there's an opportunity to like make more money, I do the exact opposite thing. I'm not quite sure why, but you know, to an extent, like having the course is great. Also because, you know, in some ways the book and the royalty structure of books kind of, if you don't have a back-end business going on already, it sort of starts to cannibalize things to where, like, if somebody gives you a speaking opportunity, if there's not enough of an honorarium, there's no way economically to make it work, because it's like, oh, some people are gonna buy a couple books if I do this talk.
Yeah.
Like, ultimately, that's not gonna.
Also, books are. I mean, you know, now that you know you sell online courses and courses are generally priced, you know, 10 to 20 times more than a book. It really makes you realize, and personally, I think books are so undervalued. Like, there's no reason for books, you know, especially the traditional, especially books that help you kind of achieve a goal. There's no reason for them to be as cheap as they are.
I think here's my thought on that, though, is that books require a lot of effort on your part. Yeah, you know, on the part of the person who's reading it. Like, they have to sit down and read it and slog through it. It's true of courses, too. Like, it does take some discipline to get through it. But there's at least like things that you can build in to make it more.
Yeah, you can make it more interactive. You can.
Long. So I think that's part of what people are paying for. You know, if a book is, my book's cover price is 40. I think it usually goes for Amazon around 25 or something.
Yeah.
You know, my courses are the numbers are going to keep going up, so I don't want to necessarily throw it out there and make anybody in the future feel like they're missing out. But you know, it's several times more of that.
Yeah.
Perhaps dozens of times more of that at some point.
You're a pro at being interviewed. You're already concerned about this being dated. And 2 years later, someone listening to this.
Well, yeah, I don't want to name some price right now, because my plan is in the future to like pack enough value into the course that there's a certain section of people who want that level of service that get that much value out of it, you know.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily about like, oh, I'm just like raising prices for the heck of it or something. It's about finding those little pain points and delivering that high value to those particular customers that care about that thing that much.
I think the other thing that's super cool about courses from a learner's perspective is the ability to interact with the person that created this, right?
Yeah.
I think that's so super cool.
It's
just nice when someone can, you know, read a book and actually ask questions, interact, and I guess that's why you also started the community.
Right, yeah, to have ways to interact with other people who are reading it, too, or who are experiencing the thing, too, who are trying to solve the same problems with it. There's not a lot of that going on with books traditionally.
Yeah, absolutely. So for someone that, you know, says, I don't know, I'm not good at making money, you did a couple of things really smartly, either intentionally or unintentionally with your course launch. One of them was the idea of having multiple like pricing tiers. You had, you know, your basic tier and your community tier. How well did that strategy work out for you? Because we talk a lot about that within the course.
Yeah. I've done a few different launches. So I basically did a beta. I've done several different launches, and I always launch for just a short amount of time, so that way I have like a cycle to go through, and I can iterate and make it better each time. And I did beta, which I think was maybe like one price, and then when I did my first launch, I had two prices. There was the basic, and there was the community. And then this latest time I did it, I basically took what was the basic and I stripped a few things out of it and made a light version.
Okay.
And then I made the sort of community version, which had all the same things that were in the community version before. And then I added a third, like, consulting type one with an even higher price. Now, I think that last one worked out the best because, at least from a psychology standpoint, sometimes if somebody sees a price, it's like $189 or $197 or something, like a good portion of your readers are going to be like, forget it. They're not even going to consider it. And so when you can offer them some sort of a lighter version, that you know, one thing some people can buy can buy that who would not buy the higher version, of course. But then there's like the anchoring, the psychological anchoring thing that goes on, which is like, well, I have decided I do want this course.
Yep.
Now this other higher one has a lot of things packed into it. Now the really high one, I don't never necessarily need that level of service. That's a too high of a price. And so they gravitate to the middle. I was actually really shocked that in the latest one where I did the three tiers that people went for that middle tier.
Yep.
More people bought the middle tier than they did the light. I was surprised.
Oh, wow.
By that.
That's interesting.
I might have packed too much stuff for the middle tier. All
the pricing psychology always tells you that, right? When there's two products, people buy the lower priced product. But you add a third product, the middle one becomes a lot more interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to caution, though, that I've gotten advice over the years from many people who do this sort of thing very well, and they always give me that advice. They're like, "Oh, you gotta have three product tiers. You've got to like think about all the different segments." And so I haven't segmented my market yet.
Yeah.
This is all learned design.
Yeah.
Which meets so many different needs. I don't even necessarily know exactly why my customers want this thing. And I know that there are different segments in there, but it's too early for me to segment.
Yep.
So I'm just being comfortable and okay with that. Also, people have told me time and time again, you know, to make these tiers. That took time to gain that level of understanding of selling something and having people buy it. And understanding that psychology and feeling it out, it took me, I'm a methodical person, it took me time. I had to do several iterations, several launches before I started to realize like, oh, okay. And also to do the work of actually making the course, you know? Sometimes when people give advice on this, they make it sound like you're just gonna like, just throw a bunch of garbage in this course. And like, no, people are gonna buy that. You have to actually think about, all right, I'm asking this price. What about this package makes me feel like I'm actually going to get my money's worth here? And that takes time. You can't necessarily go from zero to 100 on that, where you're just like first launch, you have three product levels, it's all perfectly done.
I think the one counterpoint to that, or the one quick way of kind of getting around that, is by having a product that's essentially a service at the highest level. Because that way, you're not front-loading the work. You can still provide, you know, really high quality of work after. And it's a good way, I think, for someone, especially, you know, who doesn't have a 30,000 person email list, just to start making real money, as well as set up price anchoring for just the course. If you have, you know, just the course, but your higher price tier is essentially where you do for the person what you're trying to solve. So if you're trying to teach something, you just actually do it for them.
Right. Yeah. To have a consulting level in there, which I, That's what I did for this latest one, and I've done.
Are you happy with the third level and how it's worked out?
This particular time, there wasn't a lot of people going for it.
Yeah. But it could have already served its purpose just by more people buying the middle product.
Oh, I'm sure that it did.
Yeah.
I'm sure it has that anchoring thing to it. I mean, I would like to have it packed up more with more value, to where people feel
what was
like
the
it's
service?
It was it was essentially, so light package was just 20 different 5-minute videos.
Yep.
The motivation overdrive, as it was called this time, it might be something different in the future, I don't know, was 21 videos. So it had like a bonus video, which is about user experience. It had a lesson plan, which was, you know, watch this video, do this challenge every day for 5 weeks, just like a workout program. A 10-minute challenges checklist, which was different 10-minute challenges to do along with the videos, and the community, all packed. Nice. So there was a lot packed in that middle package. The third package, on top of it, you would get like a 30-minute hangout with me, and I would also do a makeover of your site and go through it and like change around the white space and like show you things to do with the design there. I toyed around with having another thing in there, which would basically be like unlimited email advice from me for 90 days.
That can also backfire quite a lot.
Right. I want to get to that. That's very important. I want to get to that. But the thing is that when I thought about the price that I would need that to be, it was higher than I wanted to show at the time. Now, about that thing, how I could backfire, this is another thing is you know, that perfection paralysis that I've gotten, struggled with so many times, I know everybody does, is all these little maybes about all this bad stuff that can happen. If you break down a lot of those things, you can find that they're not all so bad, right? So like this idea of having 90 days email access to me, unlimited 90 days email access, which I don't even offer right now, so I hope I don't want to disappoint people, is that, you know, most people, especially my people on my list, are smart, reasonable people. That like they treat me very well. They're gonna have some level of being
self moderation
on the most on the whole. There might be maybe somebody is just like like just emailing you all the time, and then you can have a conversation about it. You can say, look, you know, let's come up with this structure of how to get feedback so I can serve you better. If things still don't work out, you can always give them their money back. Lesson learned, you know, move on. Like there's always, as long as you're asking for enough money to make it worthwhile, you know, there's always, the thing, psychologically, I think about what I'm going to learn from it if things go wrong. And the actual likelihood of things going wrong.
No, I think that's a good point. Lower, I think your mind like always focuses on the negatives and the worst case scenarios.
Yes.
And a lot of times it's probably not going to be that bad.
We are psychologically programmed to focus on the negative. Sometimes
the cost of the cost of losing something is so much greater than the cost of gaining something.
And so there's so many things about that in this process of really getting started selling that I've had to overcome over years. To flip that switch where I finally am like, oh, I'm comfortable with this. I can do this. And once that gets started, then your skills at it exponentiate.
Are there any other pricing experiments that, you know, you're thinking about running soon, or different kind of products that you could throw on to complement Design for Hackers?
I definitely had a lot of people asking about how it was different from the book, which, you know, it's more updated. It's more condensed. I've talked to people for 3 years. Now I have a better idea of how to explain these different concepts and stuff. So there were differences, but I think psychologically that was a barrier for some people. I've thought about how can I package the book up with it, or I'm not big on discounts, but maybe providing some sort of discount for people who already have the book.
I think that's interesting, right? I mean, we did, we recently ran a similar promotion with Ryan Holiday where he had Growth Hacker Marketing, the book and the course. And a lot of people were concerned that they'd already bought the book. So we found even giving them $5 less in the course really helped, just because it's more the mental thing that they feel that they got good value and they didn't do the wrong thing by buying the book.
I've done very small experiments with discounts, and it makes my skin crawl. I hate
that. I mean, that's good. You know, like there's a lot of people that go the opposite direction and start off with, you know, the boy that cried wolf with like 80% discount just today. Buy now, buy now, buy now.
Yeah, it's tough because even like, you know, I've got revenue goals that I try to reach, and it's like, oh, I could meet that revenue goal if I would provide a discount, but I've got to have this principle here. Like, I want customers that value the work that I do,
and I just don't the wrong start kind of that behavior, slippery slope. Right? You train the wrong behavior. People are then going to always wait for a discount, be skeptical, you know, when you announce a new product. So it makes a lot of sense.
There's plenty of people who will get the value out of it and are willing to pay the regular price, which is a totally reasonable price. And you know, to me, I don't want to do the discount thing. Now, I want to say this about the experimentation, though. You're mentioning pricing experiments, and I know you didn't ask about this, but I know that it's on the tip of everybody's brain. Is A/B tests. I have hardly run a single A/B test for the last 9 months or so. I just stopped. In fact, I've started running AA tests with my MailChimp. I run an A/B test and I make everything the exact same. And it's amazing what you see when you look at the difference between the A and the B on this. The exact same email. You see different open rates, you see different click rates, you see different, I mean, not always, but sometimes you see things where you're like, oh, if I had run a test and looked at this, I would have thought that this other thing did better. And I'm somebody who has 30,000 people on my email list.
So it's not an insignificant number.
I have enough to do some tests. And then, but when it also comes to like selling a course, I don't have enough people buying the course to really like come up with a number. So I don't do A/B tests. I just move forward, like do an iteration. How'd that go? Talk to the people. Why didn't you buy? Why did you buy? What were you thinking when you bought? Just talking, it's a conversation. It's not crunching data.
And
I think
so
that this
many people,
is a dangerous thing.
So many people optimize for micro optimizations. Even in the best case there, you optimize towards a local maxima. That's your best case. Your A/B test is correct. Everything's worked out, but you're still optimizing, you know, such a small aspect. You improve your click-through rate from 1.5 to 2%. I mean, great. But you don't know what happens at steps down the funnel. It's just one of those things that unless, you know, you have, unless you're at the scale where it makes a lot of sense, and I mean, you're obviously at decent scale, but even for you, not at the scale where it makes sense to do any of this, there's just better ways to spend your time.
Yeah, I mean, and it's, I just wanted to caution of that because I know there's this obsession with this A/B testing right now, and it's I think it's really sad because vision and having like a point of view about things and having some sense of like, I understand how this works and this is what I think, and trying it and saying like, okay, well, that didn't work or that did work, you know, that's where like great things are done. And and the way I see it, why make a half-ass A and a half-ass B when you can make a full-ass A?
Yeah, absolutely. And in a past life, you know, well before I was in online education, I did a lot of growth consulting, and I talked about exactly the same thing. Like, no A-B test, just try weird shit. Like, people underestimate, you know, the importance of just macro thinking about, like, random stuff, things that are so far out of left field, and just running with it. And
sometimes it's refreshing to hear you talk that way about it, man. It's that's really cool to hear. Actually, somebody else shares. I've been hiding this secret for so long about how I feel about A/B tests.
So, you know, speaking of big macro kind of things, how the hell did you pick your price when you first started?
Yeah. Well, first of all, most experts I talked to were constantly saying, double your price, double your price. You know, I looked at what I had, and I looked at the need that I was fulfilling. You know, I didn't have, like I say, it's still a pretty general thing. It's learning about design. It's understanding design. It's understanding what it is that makes something beautiful. And it's not fitting a very particular pain point. And so I accepted that. And I realized, okay, you know, this isn't going to be right off the bat a $200 course. I did a little bit of surveying of people, asking how much they spent in the previous year on learning design, which was very useful for analyzing other things in surveys. I did things where I talked to individual customers. And just in passing, they might say, oh, if something's under $100, I just
buy it.
So I knew, I figured I wanted to have something under $100. I used the old adage of that, you know, the nine end of something. And that's well documented psychologically, the effect.
Something we strongly recommend people do as well.
Yeah, so any sort of range that I'm in, I try to put a nine in front of it. But there's some other subtle things that I do that I don't know if I can explain totally, where I'll kind of look at a price and I'll look at another price and say like, ooh, if this is 79, you know, 149 looks, something's wrong with that. It needs to be 138 or something. I can't really explain that, but I try to like, you know, just shut off my brain and pretend I'm a customer for a moment and I'm making this decision, because you make that decision all the time. So think about yourself.
And I guess the other thing you've done, which even though you don't discount, you're indirectly training good behavior by using what at least we call positive discounting, which is keep increasing your price. So at some level, the current price is the lowest price, but you don't have to artificially lower anything for it.
Yeah, I've never heard of that concept, positive discounting. That sounds... That is what goes on. It is, you know, look.
And sometimes for a perpetual course, you know, when we want to produce the kind of mad flurry of sales you get when you have a discount, what we do is we announce the price goes up in 24 hours. So you have fair notice. You know, this is what the price has been, but the price is going to double, or you know, the price is going to go up by a certain percentage. Mm-hmm. You now have 24 or 48 hours before it actually happens.
That's a really good idea. I might use that at some point. Yeah. I'll have to think about that a little bit more, but that sounds really good because, yeah, I do plan to continue raising the price.
Yeah. And that does
as produce, I raise the value.
And that does produce, you know, the kind of dopamine hit of like getting like all those like purchase emails the same way you'd normally have it when you announce a 50% discount.
Getting people off the fence and taking action and actually buying is definitely important. So that's one thing that would help with that.
I guess the other way you personally do it is by having enrollment windows.
Yes.
Again, I mean, have you just done it because it provides a way to improve your content? Or has there been, like, business thought behind it, too, like, economically?
Yeah. You know, there's definitely this aspect of scarcity there. And that's a very real thing, and that has very real benefits.
Yep.
You ask the one or two angry emails that I get on my list, that's the only reason that I'm doing it.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is, there is a lot of manual stuff involved with processing these orders and with launching and with just having the headspace to manage the fact that sales are coming in and I'm one person. Having like the what I call windowed launch really helps me manage like my mental resources, I find. Yep. I just like, I've gotten very good at recognizing that sense of overwhelm in my brain. And when I'm launching, when I'm selling, that's all that matters to me in that week. And that's all I'm concentrating on. So then...
So you're either in launch mode or you're not.
I'm in launch mode and I'm not. And launch mode is brutal, man. It's a lot of work. It turns
me into
a different person. You know, and so I do the launch and then like I like analyze it. And then I step back and be a little bit creative about, well, what can I do? How can I make this better? And I try to do that work, and I gear up for another launch. And I still do a lot of manual stuff. I have assistants that help me with certain things in my business. However, all the launch stuff, I'm doing all of it. So I sell my stuff.
How much manual stuff do you have outside of obviously, you know, producing content and like putting it out there? Outside of the marketing, what do you have marginal manual work for each initial purchase?
Yes. Okay. A little bit. Right now I do, which is, I think that's something that holds people back.
Yeah. That's one of the problems we as a company are trying to solve technologically, right? We want it so that there's no marginal work for each subsequent person advisor course. Obviously excluding support and, you know, helping people out and stuff.
I mean, eventually to scale, you need to do that, but to get started, you need to absolutely forget about that stuff.
Yeah.
And that's the whole
cliche, do things that don't scale, right?
I mean, yeah, that's something that held me back for so long. I mean, just the even idea of having a landing page to sell things, I got over that by saying, well, I'll just put PayPal buttons in there. And then what did I even do? I put PayPal buttons for my beta. The course wasn't even out. It was still 3 weeks before I was going to finish producing it. I wanted the dopamine hit. Yeah. And so I put out a little test, got some money through PayPal. I'm like, oh, well, I just got like a couple $1,000. Like, I'm going
to... Now you got to do it.
I made a promise about when I'm going to deliver this course.
Yeah.
So I did it. And that was manual. And still to this day right now, I use Gumroad for collecting payments. And then they were able to download HTML files, which have the Wistia links embedded. It's not an ideal experience. It's not Fedora. It's not Fedora or anything. But but that happens, and then
I guess you have to update your MailChimp too, right? Yeah.
Well, I have to process all those orders because the way Gumroad or anybody really brings in the MailChimp data is they'll add it to a list. They'll add that person to a list, but like this person's already on this list. I want a group.
Tag them. Okay. Yeah.
So I have to. I'll like wait for the a few days of orders to come in, and I'll like download the CSV file, and then I'll manually put them.
Can MailChimp send out an email to person in group A but not group B, or can they not do that?
With MailChimp.
Oh, sorry, in list A but not list B, can you do that?
Yeah, that's the thing is that you can't send to multiple lists at a time.
Oh,
there's no point in having. The list, from what I can understand, I don't know why anybody uses it that way unless they only have one product. And I don't know. I'm still learning these things. If somebody has any idea, they can tell me. But I use groups.
Yeah.
So I have to do that manually. And then when there's I use a Facebook community. So then I have to manually
add all these people to Facebook
community. And then I've got to, and there's other things that happen where somebody will pay and they'll use a different email address than they're actually signed up with.
Oh, yeah.
So I have to look out for those new customers and figure out, like, wait, is this person subscribed with a different email? And that's got a whole manual process to it. And those are things that are, like, I'm still figuring out the process myself, so I'm not ready to delegate them.
Yeah. I was just going to be like, yeah, sounds like you need an assistant, but I guess you still don't have it codified well enough to be like...
Yeah. I'm getting there. I'll make just bullet point lists in Evernote. Where I just make the process for myself, even so that, like, next time I launch, I can go back and be like, "Oh, that's how I did that."
Yeah.
And then through that, I can start to maybe I'll because there's every once in a while there's somebody who's like, it's a real problem to figure out what their actual email address is.
Yeah.
So I can have certain things where it's like,
so do you just
do these things? If it doesn't work, put them on this list, and then it goes to me.
Yeah.
And then I figure it out. So I could do things like that. But there's manual. The point being, there's manual processes. I'm a one-person show.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that. I don't.
It seems like you enjoy it. You like being a one-person show.
Yeah, I do. And if something I fought for a long time, and it's something that I felt a little insecure about. Even when I see friends of mine who've built these businesses, they've got 20 people and they're managing all this stuff, and they've got an office maybe or something. And I realize, well, I don't want to go to an office. I'm not a natural.
Nothing special about having an office. I can tell you that.
Yeah, I mean, I go to a co-working space sometimes, but most of the time I don't want to have an office. I want to be able to, like, wake up, have my head clear, do some writing, do some creative work. I need to have that space. If I'm waking up, checking, like, how many sales I made overnight, and then trying to go do the creative work, it's not going to, like, those are two different brain modes. I can't switch gears like that.
Yeah, and I guess the advantage, one of the disadvantages I've noticed, because I used to have a lifestyle more like yours, is the constant context switching is tiring. And I guess that's one of the things you can, either be in writing mode. So when you do a scattered launch, for instance, you're either in just sales mode and you can just focus on that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I batch those contexts.
Yeah.
Where, okay, if I'm launching a particular week, that's the mental mode that I'm in. And I don't have to switch around and worry about being creative in certain ways and stuff. Yeah. And things will grow. It's just like anything else. Eventually, hopefully, I will be able to systematize certain things and have things run more smoothly. But I have to make a certain amount of money before I can justify things like that. Yeah. It's much better. There's much more progress. There's much more value being delivered to the customer by me just letting go of this idea that everything's going to be perfect and perfectly automated. And go ahead and serve those early adopters that don't really care either way.
Yep, absolutely. So how often do you like to do these launches? Is it once every few months or?
So far, it's been once every few months. We'll see. It depends upon there being a good batch of people. I mean, this is another thing. It depends upon is that there's the community aspect, and it helps to have like people coming in the community at the same time.
Yeah, because you come in super enthusiastic, and then so if you always have like a good flurry of people coming in, I'm sure that's helpful.
Yeah, that force is there to like motivate the people who've been on the community for a while to get them excited. People who are new are excited. You get them interacting. So there's all of that, but then also. Let's see here. I forgot what we're talking about.
Launches. How often we like to schedule.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. How often do I do them? So there's got to be like a good batch of new email subscribers where I can say like, okay, if I open up the course again, we'll have a good solid class coming in.
Yeah.
There's that too.
That makes sense. I guess you almost have the best of both worlds. One idea is you have a perpetual course, anyone can sign up whenever, take it whenever. The other is like a classroom where everyone's in the course at the same time. You have a good hybrid going right now where it is a self-paced class, you can take it whenever, but the community does kind of get popular at the same time. So a lot of people are facing the same problems at the same time.
Wait, what do you mean by the self-paced class?
By self-paced class, I mean, like Bitfountain, for instance, their courses, anyone can sign up whenever, so there's never any specific urgency. So given day, there's new people coming into the class. But the downside is there's never a cluster that's facing the same problems at the same time.
Yeah. So that's why I go for now. You know, at some point,
I still think, you know, if you ever kind of graduate to another product or, you know, book or something that's different from your primary brand, it might make sense to experiment with a perpetual sign up for Design for Hackers.
Oh yeah. My plan is to iterate, get the marketing really tight, get the course really tight. And then at some point, it might be an evergreen course that gets updated once in a while, but you can sign up whenever or something like that. Possibly, you know, it depends upon. It's growing. It's like while I'm doing this, I'm learning all these little micro skills that eventually just get programmed into my basal ganglia and they become automatic, and then it's not so much cognitive overhead to figure them out.
Yeah.
So.
Do you think there's going to be a point anytime soon? I mean, now the product is 3 years old, where people who come in now are no longer going to be called early adopters?
Well, I mean, the book is 3 years old. The course is 6 months old or something. People who come in aren't going to be early adopters once they're not coming from my email list.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, man. You're kind of a big deal now. I think people now, you know, who come to you are no longer early adopters. They're people who, you know you've built a brand for teaching design.
I mean, I guess maybe I perceive it. I can only perceive myself from over here, so I don't really know. The way I see it, there's definitely like plenty of people who have no idea of what I do or the way that I do things, and you know, so I have experimented with you know, I bought some Facebook ads and like tried to see, can I get somebody who's, hold on,
no worries.
So I bought some Facebook ads, and I tried to see, can I get somebody who is who has never had contact with me to buy the course?
Yep.
I just did with a couple $100 of ads. Nobody bought.
Did you link straight to the course?
I linked straight to, the landing page for the course. And yeah.
I mean, again, has to be tested, but going from ad to free email course to paid course would realistically convert better, I think.
Yeah, you're probably right. And I'm not even set up very well analytics-wise to track that yet.
Yeah.
So I'm very much focused on, all right, I've got 30,000 people. I don't necessarily need to, I experiment a little bit with ads, but I'm not working very hard on that. I'm working much harder on, look, I've already got this mound of clay, like let's form it into something. So I could, that probably would work better, but I'm not even set up to do it yet, so yeah. Might be a while.
Yeah, no, totally. That makes a lot of sense. So now that you're 6 months into the process, what is it about, you know, building a course, selling a course that you did not expect that you now know? Like, is there anything that's been totally counterintuitive that has surprised you about, you know, being an online teacher, being a teacher entrepreneur?
I guess I wasn't. I wasn't prepared for how excited people would be to take the courses.
Yeah.
It makes total sense.
Yeah.
But again, you know,
such a great humble brag. I can't believe how excited everyone
is. It? Yeah. I guess you're right. But no, that was something that surprised me. It was just like how much people were just like, oh man, I can't wait to take this course. This is great. Yeah. And it makes total sense. But I guess it's just being somebody who works by himself behind a keyboard all day. I think our amygdalas start to just think of these horrible scenarios where people are gonna.
You're
asking somebody to pay you money, that they're going to be like hostile in some way.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting. Every time I know anyone that launches any product, for the first couple of minutes until the first sale comes in, you have this thought, what if no one buys it? What if like absolutely zero people see value and buy this?
It's horrible. Even when I do the windowed launches, the first couple days are bad because like the sales are sort of trickling in and you're like, you have these projections and you have no idea, but then that last day, all of a sudden, like, Everybody
how much,
comes
how much
through.
How much revenue do you normally think comes in on the last day as a percentage?
50% for me.
Interesting.
Roughly on like a 4-day or 5-day launch, 50% or maybe more.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I always tell people if they're doing, you know, a discount, a window, anything, at least have enough time for 2 emails. At least enough time for the first and, you know, hey, this is closing in 24 hours.
And see, I mean, and see that's like just what I just said, 50%. That's like one of those little micro skill things that I think that people who have sold courses a lot take for granted, that they don't think of when they're talking to somebody who's just starting.
Yep.
Is that there's so much you don't know when you're just starting. Yep. Like, don't worry about tiered pricing and all these details and automation and stuff. Like, get to the point where you can at least say, like, oh, this price point I had a lot of resistance, and this price point I didn't, you know.
Yep.
So much for you to learn.
I think the biggest takeaway that's just been emerging from talking to a lot of people that have sold courses is just do it. There's like 100 reasons to not teach a course, 100 reasons to like strive for perfection, 100 reasons to, you know, wait for, you know, something special to happen, but just do it. Put up something you're even mildly embarrassed with. Get people coming in. And you know what? They might like it, and you might be like David and be shocked by how excited they are.
Yeah. You know, if you're good.
All right. So we're running out of time, but any parting words of advice other than, you know, what I just said?
Other than just do it. I don't really know what else I could possibly say.
any closing words for someone?
I would say, again, I want to get up on the thing about testing and A/B testing and all this obsession that people have with data. Like, especially with these first few customers, it's a conversation. Yeah. It's not a bunch of data crunching. I do a little bit of surveying with Google Forms, but I do a lot of interviewing. I do a lot of having the chat box on your landing page and talking to the people.
Yep.
It's a conversation. You have to talk to these people enough to where you're internalizing their problems and their thought process, and that you know, you become this person that just knows. And it's not because you have a graph or something that tells you X percent feel this way, X percent feel that way. Like, you have to allow that conversation to happen, at least in the beginning.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, do customer development, even if you don't call it that. Just talk to people and don't sweat the small stuff.
Right, exactly.
Yep. Cool, man. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun talking about this stuff.
Yeah. If anyone has any questions, leave it below. Thankfully, David is not busy at all and would love to respond to everyone.
Every single one, yes. Yeah. Please, just drop by my house.
Yeah. Just email him. I'll give you his email, his phone number, whatever you want.
Cool.
All right.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks again, man. It's been fun.
All right. Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.